Hello, and welcome to this online event held at the International Inequalities Institute, entitled The Economic Consequences of Major Tax Cuts for the Rich. This forms part of our inequalities seminar series and will last until around 1:30 p.m. I'm Dr. Luna Glucksberg, Research Fellow at the IAI, at the LSE, and I will be chairing the event. Today's speakers are Dr. David Hope and Dr. Julian Lindbergh. Dr. Hope is a lecturer in political economy at King's College London and is also a visiting research fellow at the International Inequalities Institute. He is interested in the intersection of economics and political science and specializes in the comparative political economy of high income democracies such as Western Europe and the United States. Dr. Lindbergh is a lecturer in public policy in the Department of Political Economy at King's College London, and his research interests are in the dynamics of inequality, tax policy making, and fiscal capacity building over the long run of history. Now, a few notes. Today's event is a Zoom meeting rather than a webinar. So that means we can see all our attendees. If you could keep your cameras on and your microphones muted where possible, that will ensure a smooth running event. If you can please be aware that this event will be recorded for video and podcast purposes. We will have time for Q&A towards the end of the event. So, and you can do two things. You can either type your questions in the chat function, start stating your name and affiliation, please, or you can use the raise hand function if you wish to ask your questions to the panel directly at the end during the Q&A. And you will be requested to unmute if invited to speak. And again, please introduce yourself with your affiliation. Now, before I hand over to our speakers, a little note on upcoming events this term at the IAI. On Thursday evening at 6 p.m., there will be the public event Building a Caring Economy, which is part of LSE's Shaping the Post-COVID World initiative. Next Monday, we will also host the event COVID-19 Inequalities and the Future of Work at 6:30 p.m. Details to both events can be found in the chat function right now, as well as more information on further upcoming events and staying up to date with the work of the II. I'll now hand over to our speakers. Just as a brief explanation, Dr. Hope will be taking the presentation and then Dr. Lindbergh will be running the Q&A, broadly speaking. Now, thank you everyone for joining and please enjoy the event. Dave, over to you.
Thanks, Luna. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. And thanks to Luna for the introduction and for chairing today's session and to the LSE III for releasing our latest working paper and for inviting us to present today. So it feels very fitting that this is sort of the first place we're going to present this work, given that this is during my time at the LSE III as a postdoc, where I really started my research journey into researching the political economy of inequality and redistribution. So as has already been mentioned, this joint work with my King's College London Department of Political Economy colleague and office mate, Dr. Julian Lindbergh. And I think it's our shared desire to work on big questions that sort of brought us together. And this big question sort of fits firmly at the intersection of our research agendas, given my work on income inequality and Julian's work on taxing the rich. So it's great to see so many people here today, which I guess might be a reflection of the sort of attention that the working paper received upon its release. It's actually been downloaded over 88,000 times already since mid-December, which I can tell you is about 87,900 times more than my last paper in the series. And that really puts the pressure on us for the next paper we release in the series. So while the sort of attention we got for the working paper, you know, took us by surprise, I think it shows the strength of the feeling around this issue, as well as the continued relevance of this question to economic policymaking in the 21st century. So we really hope our paper and our continued work in this field can sort of help contribute to the public debate in this arena. And I think it also that fits nicely with the wider aims of the LSE International Inequalities Institute. So one particularly surprising thing to come out of our working paper and the attention it received, it was became the subject of more than one Twitter meme. And as this will probably never happen again to our research, we thought we'd start today's presentation by taking a look at a couple of them. So this first one puts a sort of still from a news article that summarizes our findings. 50 years of tax cuts for the rich didn't trickle down, study says, which kind of went relatively viral on Twitter when it was released in December. It's putting it next to a still from The Simpsons, with a headline that says you need a heart to live. And we think the implication here is that, you know, our study finds what a lot of people already thought was the case. But we found it particularly interesting in the online reaction that it seemed to be very much filtered through a partisan lens. So the people that were liking this type of post were typically people on the left, and studies were confirming what they already thought, their existing beliefs. And given some of them were too rude to put on the slides, we didn't put much of the reaction on here that we got from the right, but largely there was a sort of dismissing us as socialists, you know, their highest form of insult, and extolling the virtues of the Reagan and Trump tax cuts for ordinary Americans. And this was typically done so pretty aggressively and without any supporting evidence. So some of that, you know, as people was not so pleasant, but as social scientists, we found that really interesting. The sort of real strength of partisan feeling around this policy issue. And that's something we're keen to explore in our future research and something I'll say more about at the end of today's presentation. So just before we come on to start our presentation on the research paper, then this is another meme from Twitter that got 163,000 likes. Using the same headline, but the picture on the right, I think, really indicating the sort of despair that people feel that these policies have been in place or been used for sort of 50 years now, and the promises of prosperity that their proponents said they would bring have not arrived. And I think in our research, we're aiming to sort of resolve the debate, at least in the academic literature, about the economic effects of major tax cuts for the rich. Okay, so I'm going to start the presentation about the paper proper by sort of turning back the clock around 100 years to look at this very long-running debate in economics about the relationship between tax progressivity and economic performance. So tax progressivity being sort of the higher that measure is, the more average tax rates are increasing as your income increases. Now, it's actually an argument that's, of course, commonly used today, but really wasn't seen a great deal before the 1970s, was that these steeply progressive tax systems might be a drag on economic growth. And we can see some of Steinmo's work for an overview of these type of arguments. They mainly rely on the fact that high taxes on the rich may be a disincentive to work, and they may also affect both domestic and foreign investment. And these are the type of arguments we hear pretty commonly on the right when people are advocating for tax cuts today. But actually, if we go back to the first half of the 20th century, we're looking at Schuppert, Kaldor, at these type of economists, then it would seem then that progressive taxation was seen as economically superior for a number of different reasons. So one of those reasons was a sort of Keynesian channel, which said that because the poor have a higher marginal propensity to consume out of any additional income that they receive, then it makes sense from an economic point of view to tax the rich who are less likely to spend that money in the economy, boosting consumption and growth. And also around this time when trade taxes were a very important part of taxation, some of these economists thought that it was actually less disruptive to business to tax the wealthy than it was to employ these more regressive trade taxes. So we've got this nice quote from the Cambridge economist Kaldor, right towards the end of his career and life, actually, that says, however much ministers may try to revive incentives through tax reductions, they can never hope to achieve the Victorian or Edwardian peaks in fiscal incentives when income tax was not progressive and it was 7 old pence in the pound, or 3% instead of the present 33%. Yet with all those incentives, the economy was stagnating. And so what this is really suggesting is that in the second half of the 19th century, in the early part of the 20th century, we had this situation where taxes on the rich were extremely low, but we were also in a period of economic stagnation. If we look at the post-war period, those 30 years after the Second World War, we get the exact opposite picture, where we have a period of very high taxes on the rich and also very high economic growth. So of course, these are not sort of causal, but what we can say is that certainly low taxes on the rich are not always accompanied by a booming economy, and high taxes on the rich, as we saw in the post-war period, certainly are not necessarily a break on rapid economic growth. So I also wanted to make the point that this debate isn't purely academic. It really does enter the realm of policy making. And neither is it trivial. So over the last 50 years, there's been substantial differences we've seen across administrations and across countries in tax policy making, and particular taxes on the rich. And that has significant distributive implications, i.e. major implications for income inequality. So just as a very prominent example then, we've got Donald Trump here in 2017 signing into law the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And this was a $1.5 trillion package of tax cuts, which disproportionately benefited the top 20% of the income distribution in the US, according to the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. On the other side, here we have Joe Biden, and we have the sort of promises that he's made upon in his sort of election manifesto on coming to office are that he's going to dramatically increase taxes on the rich. He's talked about increasing corporation tax, capital gains tax, income tax on households with incomes over $400,000, and also increasing the thresholds for gift tax and inheritance tax. It's going to remain to be seen whether he can get this package of tax rises through Congress. But it's clear that the approach he's going to take is going to be diametrically opposed to Trump, and that's going to have a serious distributive implications. And we saw the sort of arguments that Trump and other people in his administration were making are very typical of these type of trickle-down arguments. So Trump suggested these tax cuts would be rocket fuel for the US economy, and then Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was suggesting that they would pay for themselves through economic growth. And so we see this debate is still very much going on and still having dramatic implications on policy at the highest levels in the world's largest economy. But to just a lot of the reaction to the paper, and obviously this example is from the United States, but just say this is not just a US story, and our paper is not just focusing on the United States. So in the UK, we've got a not dissimilar debate playing out now about how to sort of plug the hole in the UK public finances that have been opened up by the pandemic. Rishi Sunak has talked reasonably seriously about increasing capital gains tax and corporation tax, because in part, the Tories have tied themselves into not raising the three main taxes, VAT, national insurance and income tax, in their manifesto. And so they haven't got much room to manoeuvre. But even given that, some other members of the cabinet, including the Work and Pensions Secretary, Therese Coffey, have suggested that actually tax cuts would be better in terms of reviving the pandemic ravaged economy. And so this debate is going on at the highest levels of UK policy making within the same party. And again, this is not just an Anglo-Saxon story, because we've been contacted since the working paper went out by the Norwegian Confederation of Trade Unions, some of whose representatives may be in the meeting today, to say that this is a very similar debate is currently playing out in Norway at present. Okay, so our study then is aiming to tie into this very long-running academic debate and also the debate that's happening around tax policy making in the advanced democracies. And the research question that we're going to be exploring is, what are the economic effects of major tax cuts for the rich? So what is the existing sort of evidence around this question? Well, we've got a lot of macro level studies. They're mostly providing correlational evidence of the relationship between taxes on the rich and economic outcomes. We've got this growing body of work, which is suggesting that there's sort of no significant association between tax progressivity and economic growth, suggesting that it doesn't sort of help or hinder the economy in terms of economic performance, changing the level of tax progressivity. But there are some exceptions, and Gemmell would be one, which would suggest that higher tax progressivity is correlated with lower economic growth. Then we've got this growing body of work looking at the relationship between top marginal income tax rates and top 1% income share, so this widely used measure of income inequality, and suggesting that lower top marginal income tax rates are associated with higher inequality on this measure of the top 1%. And just to be clear, when I say top marginal income tax rates, I'm talking about the tax rate in the highest tax bracket of income tax. For example, in the UK, it'd be 45% for those with incomes over £150,000. So we see a few limitations of the current literature in this area, which we try to improve on in the paper that we're presenting today. So firstly, most of these studies are looking at single taxes and indicators, and a lot of them focus on top marginal income tax rates because they're easily sort of comparable across different countries and over time. But, you know, the rich have many sources of income and wealth, and also they're taxed through many different avenues. So that may be missing something by just having these studies focusing on single taxes. It's also hard to make causal claims with observational data without a sort of clear identification strategy. And that may be particularly problematic in this case, because there's this wide body of political science literature that suggests that the rich organize business interests, they can influence public policy in their favor, and including sort of tax policy. So there's this risk of reverse causation. And I'm thinking here of the work of Hacker and Pearson and other political scientists. And lastly, then, where we do have more sophisticated methodologies, such as Ribolino and Waldenstrom's synthetic control method study on the effect of tax progressivity on economic outcomes, you know, they're often confined to looking at single tax reforms. And this paper looks at only three, and we're going to look at a much wider universe of tax changes. So now I'll talk about how we measure taxes on the rich and how we address what we see as that first limitation I talked about on the previous slide. So what we do is construct actually our own measure, which is a new indicator. And crucially, this can be compared across countries and across time, which is necessary for the type of panel data analysis we're going to be doing in this study. And what we use is this relatively new method called Bayesian latent variable modeling. And I won't go into the technicalities of what we do, but just to say that a latent variable is one that is not directly observed, but can be inferred from things that you can observe. And what we can observe here are a wide range of taxes on the rich and different indicators. And we use those to get to our latent variable, the unobserved sort of taxes on the rich. And we do that by looking at seven different indicators that cover taxes across three different areas. And we also look at rates and also sort of effective tax rate or tax revenues as well. So we're covering off a lot of different channels here to get a really comprehensive picture of taxes on the rich. So on the income side, we're looking at top marginal income tax rates, this commonly used measure in the rest of the literature, as well as the tax burden, so the proportion of their income that the top 1% have to give as taxation. On the capital side, we look at corporate income taxes as well, the top marginal tax on dividends and the effective tax rate on capital. And we also look at taxes on assets, so the top rate of inheritance tax in different countries, as well as tax revenue from asset taxes more generally, so wealth taxes, which are not used too frequently, but also inheritance taxes, property taxes, all of these added up as a proportion of GDP. So we're covering off many different types of taxes on the rich in this indicator. And one of the key advantages here over other methods you could use to sort of aggregate taxes on the rich into a single measure is that this is very robust to missing values for some indicators. But this allows us to construct this Bayesian latent variable for 18 countries over a 50-year period, which would not necessarily be possible if we were using a different modelling approach. So this is the data then for our comprehensive measure of taxes on the rich. We can see we have this data for 18 OECD countries, and we have it across a 50-year period from 1965 right through to 2015. So there are a few interesting things to take away from this figure. One is that this is clearly a period where we've seen dramatic declines in taxes on the rich across the advanced economies. The only country where that's not the case is Switzerland, but that's because taxes on the rich have been very low there for the entire period. Next, we can see that the Anglo-Saxon countries, in particular the UK, the US and Canada, actually had really high taxes on the rich comparably in the early part of this period. And I think it's worth pointing that out because these countries weren't always associated with low taxes on the rich as they typically are now. And also, and most importantly for the study we're presenting today, we can see that major drops in this index coincide with major tax reforms on the rich that we already know about. For example, if we look at the US, we can see the Reagan tax cuts there in 82 and 86, 87, leading to major drops in our index of taxes on the rich, which can increase our confidence that this is really picking up what we think it is. Okay, so the next step in what we do is to use the indicator we created to identify major tax cuts on the rich. And so what we do is we take the first differences of the series, which looks at the year-on-year changes in our indicator of taxes on the rich. We then calculate the standard deviation of that, which is a measure of its dispersion. And we look at years in which the index fell by over two standard deviations. So these are particularly big drops in the index. So we use this threshold in part because it fits with our theoretical focus of looking at major tax cuts on the rich, but also this threshold is used in other literature, namely the empirical literature in macroeconomics often uses this to sort of look at the effect of large shocks. And we've also seen in some of the very influential work around large fiscal policy changes by people like Alberto Alesina, these size of shocks are often the ones that are looked at in this literature. But we also carry out our analysis with a lower threshold, one of one standard deviation, as a sort of robustness test of our main results. And I'll present those results as well later. Okay, so here is our binary indicator for major tax cuts on the rich. That's created from the process I talked about on the previous slide. This is with our two standard deviation threshold. And what we get here are 30 country year observations where we have major tax cuts on the rich. We can see that the, which is shown by the red squares on the figure, these are our major tax cuts for the rich. We see that they're pretty well spread across our countries and also across time periods, although there is some clustering around the late 80s, early 90s, when a number of countries introduced major tax cuts on the rich. There are only two countries here at the bottom, Switzerland and France, where we don't see major tax cuts for the rich over this whole period. Switzerland, again, because they were very low for the whole period. In France, they did come down pretty dramatically over the period, but they were pretty gradual. And so then it doesn't pick it up having these major tax cuts that we see in other countries. And then as a sort of comparison and robustness test, we also look at one standard deviation threshold. Of course, this picks up many more tax cuts on the rich of smaller magnitude. And so here we have 82 country year observations where we have tax cuts on the rich. And again, they're pretty spread out across time and across countries, some clustering again in this late 80s, early 90s period. And even Switzerland sneaks in there with one tax cut for the rich in 2008. So there's at least one in every country on this measure. So turning next to the empirical strategy we use then to estimate the economic effects of these major tax cuts on the rich. And we can see from the previous slide that there were many countries that were cutting taxes on the rich over this period. And so if we were to focus on a sort of single reform in a single country, that may be missing an important part of the picture. And also we've talked earlier in the presentation about how many of these studies on this topic lack a clear identification strategy. And so we're aiming to push for the literature in this field by utilizing this new method for causal inference in observational studies by Ime et al. From last year. And it's a generalization of the difference in differences estimator that implements Hall-Nobis matching in panel data analysis. And I'll come on to talk a bit more about what that actually entails. And so there are three main ideas here if we try and boil this down to make it relatively digestible. So we're comparing countries here that have similar pre-treatment trajectories, i.e. that didn't experience tax cuts for the 5 years before the tax cut that we're looking at. And we compare a country that implemented a tax cut on the rich to those that didn't in the same time period. And then we look at the trajectories after the tax cut to see if they are different between the countries that implemented the tax cuts and those that didn't. Of course, taking into account any difference that was there prior to the tax being introduced on these measures, which is the difference in differences element of this estimation. So we're also permitted, due to the panel nature of our data, to calculate the difference in differences estimator for different lags and leads. So the lags allow us to estimate the development of the estimator over time. And what we choose to do with this is to look at the effect on income inequality, on growth, on GDP of these major tax cuts up to 5 years after the reform takes place, in case these things take a while to filter through to affect economic outcomes. And on the lead side, this allows us to check really the central assumption of a differences in differences estimator, which is the parallel trends assumption, which is that for your treatment and your control, the difference between them is constant over time prior to the treatment being introduced, which in this case is a major tax cut for the rich. And then we use this Mallinobis distance matching to compare countries that have similar covariate trajectories. So the control group then, when we use that distance matching, is a matching of countries that are similar on covariates as the country that's implementing the tax cut. Okay, so the last thing then before we come on to the results is just to talk about the data we're using for our study and the three different dependent variables that we have. So firstly, we're looking at the effects of these major tax cuts for the rich on income inequality. And the measure we use for that is the top 1% share of pre-tax national income. This is from the World Inequality Database and has been constructed from administrative tax records. And so it's sort of comparable across countries and over time and is a very commonly used measure in the literature by Piketty, co-authors, and many other scholars since then. Then we look at economic growth and per capita in constant logged values. And lastly, we look at unemployment. We want to make sure these unemployment measures are consistent across countries. So we use the OECD's harmonized unemployment rates. And so we're looking at the effect of these tax cuts on the income distribution, but also on economic performance for economic growth and unemployment. We then, for when we introduce our models with the covariate matching, we have these time-varying variables that we match upon. things like capital account openness and trade openness on the economic side, and then on the political side, vote share of left parties in the last election and government expenditure as a percentage of GDP. And these are sort of commonly used indicators in the literature to in the determinants of these economic outcomes. And then just to ensure our standard errors are the correct ones to use for inference in this case, we use this block bootstrap procedure that's specifically designed for the method we're using, which uses a matching with panel data. Okay, so what are the results of the study? So we're going to start off by looking at the results for income inequality. And this is, remember, our top 1% income share. What we're looking at here is how the sort of treatment effect evolves over time. And the treatment is taking place here at period zero. And so the blue line is showing the sort of cumulative treatment effect, the dark blue line, and then the blue shading is showing the 95% confidence intervals. We can see here, if we look past zero, that we get this statistically significant increase in income inequality as a result of a major tax cut for the rich, which increases in size over time. So it's 0.6 percentage points increase in top 1% income share after 3 years, and then 0.8% percentage points, after 5 years. So just to put this into some context then, for the United States, the bottom 10% of the income distribution has an income share of just 1.8%. And so 0.8% increase in the top 1% income share for every major tax cut on the rich is a pretty sizable effect. And remember that a lot of countries in the sample introduced more than one tax cut for the major tax cut for the rich over this period of time. So this is suggesting that cutting taxes on the rich has been pretty instrumental in rising income inequality in the advanced democracy since the 1980s on this measure of top 1% income share. If we look actually before the tax cut is introduced in the sort of pre-treatment period, we can see that there are no statistically significant effects during this period, which suggests that our parallel trends assumption, which is central to a difference in differences estimator, holds during this period. Now we get a very different picture when we turn to look at economic performance and we look here at economic growth. We can see that there, in the, both the short term and the medium term, that there's no statistically significant effect on economic growth of a major tax cut for the rich. And we also can see that these effects are statistically indistinguishable from zero, both before and after the treatment is introduced. And we get slightly more variation in the estimates when we look at unemployment. But again, we can see from the confidence intervals that there's not a statistically significant effect in the pre or post treatment period. When major tax cuts happen, this would suggest that there's no effect on unemployment. So this paper is, still a work in progress, and we're going through another iteration of the paper now, one which will really bulk up the robustness test section of the paper before we think about submitting this anywhere. But one of the tests we've done already is just to change the threshold we use to identify major tax cuts on the rich. And this is the results for inequality when we have a one standard deviation threshold, which of course is a more conservative estimate of major tax cuts on the rich. It encompasses a lot of smaller tax cuts on the rich than we have in our two standard deviation model. And so we would expect the effects to be smaller, but it also helps with the robustness of our main results if we see a statistically significant effect still on income inequality, which is exactly what we do see here, although the effect is smaller, being around 0.5 percentage points after 5 years from a one standard deviation reduction in major taxes, in taxes on the rich. So again, we get a pretty similar picture with growth where we don't see any statistically significant effects in the pre or post treatment periods. And in unemployment, we ultimately get a pretty similar picture, although initially with the smaller tax cuts for the rich, it suggests there's actually an increase in unemployment after they're introduced, but actually this effect after a few years becomes statistically insignificant again. And so it doesn't seem like there are robust effects across our different specifications for the effect of tax cuts for the rich on unemployment. Okay, so to provide some conclusions that we have from our study so far, major tax cuts on the rich don't seem to boost the economy. And the effects we find on growth on unemployment, they're neither statistically nor substantively significant after major tax cuts for the rich. And so I think this ties back into the headline that was used in the Bloomberg piece that was used for the memes I showed at the beginning, in that the sort of idea of major tax cuts for the rich trickling down to be the key to wider economic prosperity, you know, an argument that's typically made by proponents of these types of tax cuts, doesn't seem to take place in our study looking at tax cuts over 50 years in 18 countries. The main effect we see in our results is that income inequality increases, and this is measured in this study by the top 1% income share. Now we, at least in this version of the paper, don't go much into the mechanisms that might be behind this. It's difficult to do that with the type of empirical approach that we've used. But our results would seem to align with some of Piketty and his co-author's work that suggests actually that it's the sort of fact that when the rich have major tax cuts, they see it as in their interest to more aggressively bargain for their own compensation. And that sort of is to the direct detriment of people lower down the income distribution. We think it's less likely actually our results are being driven by tax avoidance, which you might think is also a big factor here, given that our measure of income inequality actually picks up both capital income and labour income, and so is picking up potentially one of the major routes through which the rich could avoid tax if, say, top marginal income tax rates were to increase. Okay, so I'm just going to end the presentation then by talking a little bit about sort of future research that we're hoping to do, and also that maybe other people will do building on our study. So certainly further differentiation could be possible here. There could be differences in tax cuts on the different areas of taxes for the rich that we looked at, so personal income, corporate taxes or wealth, and maybe that could be something that could be investigated. There could also be heterogeneous effects across countries. And you know, both Julian and I are sort of work a bit in comparative political economy. And so we put a lot of stock in national institutions for being a factor in economic outcomes. And so perhaps say labor market institutions might sort of condition the effects that we find here. And that may be something to look into, although it's difficult to do sort of interaction effects that would be required to do that with the type of methodology we've used here. And also our study, you know, is limited due to data availability to the OECD countries. And so it'd be interesting to see whether these findings also hold, you know, in countries with lower levels of fiscal capacity. So as I've sort of already pointed to, I think our study is providing evidence that these trickle-down sort of policies are not really very efficient macroeconomic tools. However, it's a very persistent idea around trickle-down economics. And certainly we saw that from the reaction to our paper, in that, you know, people really believed that this actually works. And also that they've been benefiting from tax cuts, when a lot of research would suggest that the benefits of those taxes have gone to people higher up the income distribution. And so, you know, as sort of political economists, we find that particularly interesting. And so we're hoping, well, we've got some funding ready to do some survey experiments to hopefully shed more light on this question. We're currently in the design phase, but we're thinking of potentially exposing survey participants to sort of informational treatments about the economic effects of major tax cuts for the rich, seeing to what extent that changes people's preferences on this policy issue, and also to what extent that is filtered through a partisan lens or not, to see why these ideas are sort of so sticky over time. And lastly, then, we sort of currently got a book proposal on the trickle-down myth, which is under review at a university press. And so hopefully that's going to draw together some of this more empirical work on what the actual effects of cutting taxes on the rich are, with some of this stuff around economic ideas and the power and persistence of these type of trickle-down arguments. Okay, thanks very much for your attention, and we look forward to taking any questions you have about the project.
Thank you very much, Dave. And I believe I've got Chico Ferreira asking a question. Chico.
Hi, David and Julian. Thank you very much. That was that's really interesting, interesting paper. And its effect on your download statistics is a similar effect to the download statistics of the III as a whole. So we were we were delighted with that. Let me ask you two questions on the paper itself. One is almost a suggestion rather than a question, but the I guess phrased as a question, it would be, you know, amongst your robustness tests and things that you might do, I wonder if you'd consider looking at other measures of inequality. You know, this top 1% share is of course very fashionable these days, and it makes sense, but it is only sensitive to the very, very top, and people might say, look, they're transfers and changes happening elsewhere in the distribution, which something more traditional like the Gini index or the Tile index would pick up, and which the top 1% share doesn't. And so I wonder if you look at that as well. And the second one is your null results, your nil results on growth and unemployment are very convincing. On inequality, the first picture you showed of the two standard deviations one, I wonder whether you'd worry that there's a power issue there, in the sense that, you know, for the parallel trends assumption, for the pre-existing differences, you do have a pretty strong upward sloping tendency there, which people might say, look, this fits in with what we'd expect about inequality, which is that there was skill bias, technical change, you know, there was trade, there were all kinds of other things causing inequality to rise. You reject that, and you find that you can keep, you know, you are able to reject that trends were not parallel at 95%, but at some lower level of significance, you probably would not have. So I wonder at what p-value that band that you showed there falls below zero, and you know whether you might, you know, you have an observational study with countries and years. There's not a lot you can do about sample size, but could it be driven by power? Right, by lack of power. So those are my two questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. These are actually excellent points. On the first one, on the robustness with other inequality measures, this is exactly something that we've already started to compile the data set as we continue to add to the robustness section. So looking at, I think we have the top 10% share, then we have a 90-50 ratio, and probably also do something with Gini coefficients, so to add more measures there. So we're currently putting together that data and then running the models. And so this is really excellent. This is directly in line with what we also thought where we would go with the robustness test there. And then on the power issue, this is a good point. I mean, we don't see it either when we go for a lower threshold, which increases the amount of observations we have in the treatment group, and we still find similar results, although at a lower effect size there. But it also holds to using different specification actually. So whatever specification we do for the inequality data, we see the similar trend that it only turns significant right after the tax cut sets in. And looking at the confidence intervals, it's always way below 90% confidence. So it never reaches the 90% confidence interval prior to the development or prior to the tax cuts, actually. Yeah. But I think this is also a good point because at the moment we're only showing the 95% confidence intervals. So I think it's also easy to do just also to visualize that actually, to add those additional confidence intervals, particularly for the pre-treatment period into the graphs as well. So thanks a lot for that.
I will exercise chair privileges and ask a question myself, if that's okay. And it's not a technical one this time, but picking up on the areas that you highlighted for further research, I was struck by how what you describe as the beliefs that seems to endure in the face of facts, in the myth of trickle-down effects. Is there any way that it can be related a little bit to what people seem to believe about inheritance tax, which seems to have a similar thing in that it benefits only very, very large estates, and yet it is hated across the board by everyone? I don't know. It is just an impression, and it might be that it's irrelevant, but could it be possible to test that? Is that something that one could do?
Yeah, this is a really good point. The issue of the inheritance tax has been haunting me for several years now, because it's for me like a massive puzzle, because there it's even there we don't even have this disagreement in the economics profession, not even in the 80s, I would say, because it has always been seen as a very efficient tax instrument, causing little disruption, actually. So this overall idea behind that has not even been that strong with the inheritance tax. I mean, to a certain extent, yes, there's definitely also a partisan preference stability issue going on, because we see that this is highly polarized on the partisan level, but still on average, the support for the inheritance tax is not that high. So I would think there are other things playing in there as well. Now, what exactly those issues might be in the case of the inheritance tax is still a bit unclear, I would say, and particularly why it has become so unpopular, because if we look back to the post-war period, inheritance taxes, particularly in the US and in the UK, top inheritance tax rates have been higher than 80% in some cases. Yes. So it seems like it has not always been that unpopular, and explanations that kind of put forward the reason for this, for the inheritance tax being unpopular, because it's kind of connected to it's connected to death, basically, and that never goes down so well in public opinion. I mean, it must have been different then at some point in time, and there are these war explanations that say, okay, there's compensation, there was like compensatory arguments during wars that have driven them up. But this is a very good question, I would say. And it also speaks to the differentiation, not only in the effects, but also in the causes of what's driving tax policy making when we zoom in on different taxes. I mean, the advantage of our approach is really to put them all together to come up with a comprehensive approach of measuring it and then looking at the effects. But this is a really good point.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Julian. Now I have an abundance of questions. So I think I'll take Daniel first, and then I'll read. I have questions. I have 1, 2, and 3 in the chat. So how do you want to do it, guys? Do you want to take them all in one go, or how would you prefer to do it?
Oh, I think we can take them all. That's okay.
So Daniel, if you could please unmute yourself.
Yep. Thanks so much for the really interesting presentation. I really liked the use of the matching plus difference and differences. I think it's a very good idea for dealing with this kind of data. I want to hear more about how you create your measure of major tax cuts for the rich, and kind of why you chose the specific indicators that went into it. One concern I have is, is this measure just telling us what happens when there are tax cuts in general or tax reforms in general, rather than specifically tax cuts targeted at the rich?
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, thank you, Daniel. Do you want to sort of park it and get the other questions, or would you rather respond straight away?
Now that I'm already talking, I think I could directly answer this, so that's fine. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Right,
that's
sure.
A really good point. I mean, our approach here was really to pick indicators that are commonly used to measuring really the top, tax progressivity at the very top. So we don't take things that would capture like more broader tax bases. So for instance, we don't look at overall income tax revenue. We also don't look at other taxes that are commonly perceived as falling more onto middle or lower income classes, basically. But what we are looking here is really like top inheritance tax rates, top average effective tax rates. So always for the highest income earners there as well. Then for companies, so corporate tax cuts, where we know this is heavily based upon, or corporate income heavily falls upon the richest members of society, and also top inheritance tax rates as well. So that's the approach we're dealing with there. And actually, if we put the data we've put together there in the and compare it, for instance, to the development of VAT rates or something like this, which would be a measurement of normal or like fiscal reforms that would fall on a broader segment of the population, we see that they really go in different, in opposite trend, because what we can see since the 1980s, for instance, VAT rates have been going up. And actually the overall tax take hasn't developed or hasn't decreased that much, because the overall revenue to GDP ratio is more or less stable. So we don't see these downward trends that we see in our indicator here, which would lead us to be very confident in that this is really capturing something that is happening at the top of the tax code.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
Brilliant. Thank you, Julian. Now I have a question from Zulaika, a student at King's College. And she's asking, what is your opinion on tax cuts for the philanthropists to do charity and creating funds, i.e. Bill Gates, believing that that's a more effective way to give aid in contrast to government aid? And then I tell you what, I'll do all three so that you can kind of think about them. I have Sebastiano, who recently completed our MSc in Inequalities and Social Sciences here at the Institute at LSE. And he asked, would you consider interesting comparing your findings with the predictions on economic growth made before, during the tax cuts by major non-partisan organizations, such as the OECD in the US? Do official predictions consistently overestimate the impact of tax cuts on the rich on economic growth? And if this happens, what models or data are these projections based on? So that's the second question. And then the third, and we'll probably end up with these being the last questions because we've only got 10 minutes to respond. We have Torben, MSc in Psychology of Economic Life at LSE. Thanks you for the presentation, and asks, two other arguments for trickle-down economics are that with higher taxes, the rich just leave the country, especially relevant for European countries where taxes are based on residency rather than citizenship, like in the US, and that low taxes attract way more FDI. Mm-hmm. And I'd be curious to hear your take on that. So these are three questions for you guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. These are excellent questions. I mean, the first questions on the philanthropolis, this is a difficult word for a non-native speaker to pronounce. I mean, this is really something to get philosophical about, I would say. My empirical take on it would be that if we look at the data, what we see is actually still that inequality increases. So if this was the case, if it would say like, well, it would kind of lead to a better provision of public services because they know better how to spend it and so on, then I'm still a bit, I would doubt that a bit, because we still see this concentration and not the concentration at the top and not really that much of spending on these issues. And also this is the question, and should that be in the realm of the fiscal state, so to speak, which has democratically elected leaders distributing funds, or should it be in the hand of a philanthropist who distributes these economic means? But I think this is very much a philosophical question. Then, of course, one could also look at it by looking at other outcome measures there. So, what's the performance point in it? At least when we look at aggregate measures on unemployment and GDP and so on, we don't really see an effect there. With the second one, with normal approaches, normally overestimating effects, I mean, this is a bit of a difficult question. I think most approaches that we can see, and this is also a discussion that we saw post the Trump tax cuts, actually, is that they don't really take a comparative view, or they don't really take into account, or think at least about it, what's the counterfactual, right? So if you look at public debates when it comes to the Trump tax cuts, also the Reagan tax cut, what we can see there was economic growth afterwards, right? And the 80s were a time of economic growth. So was the time from 2016 to 2019, at least in the US. So if we just look at that, we could say like, well, we see that economic growth is actually increasing. But for instance, with the Trump tax cuts of 2017, we can see there was already, the economy was already starting to boom beforehand. And we see a similar economic development in other advanced democracies, which should be the point of comparison there. So I think this is also something that we really try to push with this paper, to take into account what we can see, at least how we can use other data as comparison groups to get to something closer than some causal estimate. And finally, the point on tax evasion, this is a really good one as well, because I mean, several issues come into play here. Yes, tax evasion has been an issue for a long time. Of course, it's hard, or well, changing residence is always cumbersome. So you have to change your whole residence and move to a different country. That's the first issue. It's different if it's based on citizenship, for sure. But also when it comes to fight against tax evasion, this is something that has become much stronger. So the idea that you as an individual move to a different country or use tax evasion to go somewhere else is basically also has often been pushed forward by countries, by people not moving, but by them using using a lack of international data sharing when it comes, for instance, to capital income. And this is something where recently there have been strong movements and legislation, international cooperation that actually leads to more data sharing, making this also much harder, despite the fact that this is really an issue that only really happens at the very, very top, if you can actually, we're talking about even more than the 1%, probably the 0.1% or so, when you really would take the step and move permanently to a different country, let alone changing citizenship. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much to our speakers, Dr. David Hope and Dr. Julia Lindberg. And thank you everyone for coming and participating in this IAI seminar. I hope to see you for our next event. And once again, many thanks to our speakers.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Luna. Thanks everyone for coming.
Thank you.